Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with politics and John King. Good news and bad for the Affordable Care Act. Good news and bad for Chris Christie. And is Jeb Bush the one? Then MBTA General Manager Bev Scott joins us. The numbers are in on weekend one of late night tea service. We'll also talk fare hikes and the two-year closing of Government Center Station. Then Hari Kondabolu. It was David Letterman last week for the stand-up comic, Boston Public Radio Today.
It is April Fool's Day, and for the 16th year in a row, I snookered Jim Browdy. We'll get your take on the best and worst of April Fool's foolery. Then Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane is with us to talk income inequality. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So in the last 24 hours for the Boston Red Sox, it's been the worst of times and the best of times.
2-2, got him, and the Orioles win it. And opening day, 2-1 win against the Red Sox.
But beards or no beards, it is an honor to welcome the 2013 World Series champion, Boston Red Sox, to the White House.
Trust me, nothing feels more precarious than live radio. Marjorie knows this. And being 30 seconds from showtime, and you're still wondering if your guest is going to show up. You can feel your blood pressure rise, the beads of sweat form on your head, the minutes of all that dead air stretch before you. Well, that's how Marjorie and I felt until a second ago. We thought John King was going to be a no-show after going to the Orioles opening day to see the Sox go down. But apparently his passion for baseball is rivaled by his passion for politics. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent, the Red Sox number one fan, and host of the Sunday morning show, Inside Politics. Thanks for showing up, John.
If I didn't make it, you could have grabbed anybody from Chalmette Station, just get on the red line and go pick somebody up in the old hood. But, you know, my passion for Jim and Marjorie, too. Don't give that up. Of course I'm here.
Oh,
that
we
is
love
beautiful,
that.
John.
You know, Jim had an office pool going here, John, and he lost a big time because here you are.
Don't bet against me. And, you know, it's only one game. You can't be a baseball fan. Would you like to win opening day? Do you wish John Lester didn't throw that one bad pitch that Nelson Cruz sent flying? Of course you do. But, you know, come on, Jim. You got to have the long view.
Yeah. Well, it did look like it was gorgeous down there. The sun was out. Not warm, but like in the high 50s, right? So it was a decent day.
I've been at Fenway in April, and, you know, the Camden weather was quite nice. I hope they get it to Boston when the Sox are home next week. It was very nice. I had nice seats in the third row out in the left field, third baseline, and the beer was cold, and it was a great game. It was a great game. They left as many people on base as signed up for Obamacare in the last 6 months. But, you know, it's the first day of the season. We'll get there.
Well, that was a very nice segue, John King from CNN, to Obamacare. The deadline has passed now to sign up, and the numbers were pretty good. I mean, very good, and yet the poll numbers, 26% of Americans, I think that's the lowest ever, are happy with Obamacare. So do we know, I mean, what the political fallout is yet of this, and do we know whether the younger people that he needs, the 18 to 34-year-olds, so-called invincibles, have even signed up?
Those are two very different and very important questions. So let's start with the policy. I think they deserve praise, kudos, even if you don't agree with the law. If you think, remember, they had 106,000 people enrolled after the first month. Now they're at or slightly above the 7 million mark. That took a lot of hustle. It took a lot of work. It took a lot of getting right things they first got wrong. Now we don't know how many of them are younger, how many are older, how many have actually paid for the premiums already. So we need to scrub all that. And you know, how many of them had health insurance beforehand? Are they just switching? So we don't know some of the key numbers here, but without a doubt, from a policy standpoint, from putting the foundation under the House of Obamacare, they've gone from one brick to a pretty solid foundation now. On the policy front, that doesn't mean people who disagreed with the program are going to agree with the program now, and it doesn't mean that they're not going to have more turmoil when maybe people realize, if they haven't already, they can't keep their doctor for that group of people, or their premiums will go up for some people. So some people will like it, some people won't, some people will be in the middle on the policy side. The politics side is the great question. And part of this, right now, the Republicans think this drives their base. They don't like the program. They don't like the president. We're going to continue to criticize it, especially if you look at where the most competitive Senate races are this year. They're in relatively conservative or very conservative states, even states held by Democrats. So the Republicans don't think the politics have changed that much. But forgive me for rambling. Here's how I'll close. If the Democrats want to take the policy numbers and try to change the politics, it requires one word, courage. They have to stand up and fight for the program. Now, the president's going to come out and speak about it this afternoon. His name's on the program. Are you going to see Senator Landrieu in Louisiana, Senator Pryor in Arkansas, Senator Begich in Alaska? I could go on and on and on. Will you see vulnerable Democrats now stand up and say, I'm proud of my vote? Or will they continue to duck? If they continue to duck, then they'll continue to have a problem.
You know, John, we spend so much time talking about the ineptitude of the rollout. I feel we have an obligation to talk for a minute about the skills of the last month or so. How did they pull these numbers together? Nobody was predicting in the beginning that they'd reach anywhere near their goal. Was it the threat of fines? Was it celebrities pitching this thing? What's the conventional wisdom on why all of a sudden this enrollment thing caught fire?
I think it's all of the above, and some of the credit should go to the states. So some states have done a much better job than others in getting the state exchanges ready. The states that don't have people, you know, go straight to the federal exchange. I happen to live just over the District of Columbia line in Maryland, and I know from friends and neighbors that the Maryland exchange has been a disaster. They had the same issues, the disastrous website, disastrous whole IT thing. They brought in the Connecticut company, which apparently Connecticut's been a great success. The president doing a lot of this unconventional media and the president's staff doing a lot of unconventional media, everything from radio to, you know, Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. And a lot of people kind of ridiculed them. Saturday Night Live this past weekend did a great, very funny parody skit of all the things the White House has done. But guess what? It seems to have worked. It seems to have drummed up interest. And I think some of it is, you know, just basic, oh, no, here's the deadline. Look, we're a procrastinating society. And I think a lot of people did wait till the last minute. But so now they've got the numbers, and we'll scrub the numbers, and there'll be something in the numbers that, you know, will be somewhat critical, or they didn't meet that goal. But they've come a long way, and this is where this debate, in my view, is changing. Paul Ryan has the new House Republican budget. It continues to call for the repeal of Obamacare. I just don't see it. Even if the Republicans take the Senate and keep the House, they'll take the Senate by two or three seats, and you'll have a Democratic president for two more years. Then we go into a presidential election. I don't see, even if the Republicans keep both houses of Congress and win the presidency in 2016, I assume the Democrats are still going to have, you know, high 40s in the Senate. If that plays out, maybe they'll get the Senate back. How are you going to repeal Obamacare? I don't see it happening. You might have significant changes to it if the Republicans win the next couple of elections. Yeah. But I think the repeal part is starting to sound more and more hollow.
We don't know yet, though, right, about the numbers. We don't know who signed up, who made up these 7 million people, if those so-called invincibles are in that group in any large numbers, despite the president's, I thought, wonderfully politically, I mean, his comedic timing was pretty good in the Two Ferns show there, despite that we don't know yet, right?
We don't. Let's see when we hear from him this afternoon. He speaks in a few hours, and we'll see. What they have said is that they get the threshold numbers, and it takes them a while to get all the other numbers because people go on the federal portal or the state portal to sign up, but then you actually pay your private insurance company, unless you're one of the Medicaid people. But if you've got 7 million plus signing up through the web portals, another 3.5 closing in on 4 million who are getting coverage through expanded Medicaid, I do think if you're someone out there who says, well, the goal of this program was supposed to be to expand access, to reduce the percentage of Americans who don't have health insurance, those people are the ones saying this is a policy success. This is what we set out to do. And maybe it was messy, but we're getting – that was the point. And this, in some ways, is a moot conversation with the people in Massachusetts because, you know, they're way ahead of the curve on this one, you know, like it or not. I'm sure there's some people listening who maybe don't like the Massachusetts program. But that was the goal, and they're getting there. The question is, was it so messy, and was it just so polarizing in that you never had any Republican votes for it to begin with, that the political debate about Obamacare – will long outlive, the policy and the rollout questions.
And by speaking of messy, even though obviously it started here and the website was operating terrifically until October, until the federal law, until we had to switch over, the website here has been a mess, a la Maryland too. John, I want to stay on numbers just for a second. One of your great skills is to look beyond the surface of poll numbers. This most recent poll that everybody's been quoting, 26% approval for the Affordable Care Act, as Marjorie said, Why is it that low? Is it because the Republicans have been doing a great job of trashing it? It's big government, which whether it is or not at its worst, because the Obama people haven't done a good sell job, because people don't like the content, because they don't understand the content. Why are only 1 in 4 Americans supportive of this thing in early 2014?
The answer is yes, if you go back through your list, in the sense that it's all of the above. It's a combination of things. And there are some other polls. There was an ABC Washington Post poll out yesterday that had support for the program at an all-time high, like 49 or 48% of people who say they support it now. So we're seeing conflicting poll results. There's
49% said they approved it?
There's 48 or 49.
I missed that. Wow.
Yeah. At 49, I'm looking at now the ABC Washington Post poll. Americans are split 49% support, 48% opposed. But here's this: almost don't read the first or the headline in a poll, number one, because this is anything in politics is complicated because of the divide in the country. This is especially complicated because healthcare is so personal to everybody.
Yeah.
And remember, of the people who oppose Obamacare, somewhere in the 12% to 15% ballpark oppose it because they don't think it went far enough. They're liberals who want a single-payer system. And so Republicans say a majority oppose or, you know, nearly a majority oppose, and they're right, except a slice of that, you know, want to go more to the left, think the president copped out and should have gone for single-payer. So they're not exactly running to hug, you know, John Boehner or Paul Ryan. But, again, you can look at these national polls, but then set them aside and look at the map and look at where the 14 key Senate races are this year. And you're talking about Alaska, West Virginia, South Dakota, Montana, Louisiana, North Carolina. You're not talking about places, most of them Obama didn't win, didn't carry those states. So if the president didn't win them, you can just guess what the views of healthcare are in those states. And you can just guess how the president, if he didn't win him in 2012, in a midterm year where he's in the dumps a bit, his standing and healthcare standing is a little lower. So the national polls are they're helpful, but if you're thinking about what's going to happen between now and November, sometimes they can be distracting and actually misleading. But this is the debate. For me, the question is, Republicans know what they're going to say. They're going to say, we either want to repeal it or significantly change it. What do the Democrats say? When Nancy Pelosi says run on it, the president says it's a policy success, but all these Senate candidates around the country are saying I still want to change it because they need to prove back home in their states that they're willing to stand up to the president and fight to change it.
We're talking with John King from CNN. John, I'm dying to talk to you about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who looks certainly like he's running for president. You talked about this on Inside Politics, your show on Sunday. But basically, everybody knows about Bridgegate, where the traffic was stopped for hours. And
days.
Days, exactly. And Governor Christie, since then, has hired his own lawyer at taxpayer expense. They didn't interview key witnesses. And he has cleared himself. I don't get how this is a winning strategy for him to move on to the campaign of presidency if he's going to go there. I don't get it.
Well, you're exactly right. And so there's reality in this perception, and sometimes politics perception is reality. So what he's trying to convince people is that we have this report and it says I did nothing wrong, so stop worrying about this. And let's start thinking about me as a national candidate again. Let's start thinking about me as a governor again. This has paralyzed him in New Jersey, too. It's not just paralyzed him or caused a cloud over his head when it comes to his national aspirations. And so he's trying to convince people, don't worry. Here's what my report says. And trust me, when the U.S. attorney is done and when the legislature is done with their investigations, they're going to come to the same conclusion. If you're inclined to believe Chris Christie, you might think, okay, I trust him. But you're right. They did not interview the key witnesses. The taxpayers paid for this. I think they made a definitive mistake in not only attacking one of the key witnesses, his former deputy chief of staff, but in raising questions about her personal character.
Oh, this is, yes.
And Bridget Kelly, and about whether she snapped because of some personal relationship. Look, I'm just going to go back. I would call this the Whitey Bulger rule. If there's somebody out there who can testify against you, who knows a lot, you probably don't want to get into a public fight with them if you're Chris Christie. So I tactically, I don't think that was a good idea. Plus, it seems sexist. They seem to be playing big, strong white guys playing a sexist card like she couldn't handle the pressure or something. I think that's potentially dangerous. But let's assume for the sake of argument, in the end, Chris Christie's report is what the U.S. attorney finds and the legislature finds. There are some big problems there. When? These investigations are going to go on for months and months and months. And in the meantime, It might seem silly to some people, but 2016, the early stages of it are well underway. And so when the Republican establishment sees how well Rand Paul is organizing in key states, when they see how well he is reaching beyond his libertarian base and his Tea Party base and beginning to get more mainstream establishment support, they get nervous because they don't like his views on foreign policy. They don't like his views on some other things. Some people just don't like him personally. So they're looking for a horse. And a lot of guys who 6 months ago after Chris Christie won re-election were like, that's our guy, are now saying, well, I'm not so sure. And so they're calling up Jeb Bush, and they're calling up Paul Ryan, and they're taking another look at some other Republicans. And that's what hurts Christie. Now, if this thing's over by the end of this year or early next year, and he's found that he did nothing wrong, and he goes guns to the metal, this will be a test of him as a politician. I think the greatest test for any politician is when you get knocked down, can you get back up?
Yep.
And how do you get back up? And that's why even a lot of people who maybe don't like Bill Clinton's politics, you have to respect Bill Clinton because of how many times he got knocked down for a whole different reasons, a host of different reasons, but he kept getting back up. We're going to learn a lot about Chris Christie. And in a way, if you want to be president of the United States, those are the kinds of tests you have to pass.
We're talking with John King from CNN. We're going to get to Jeb Bush in just 1 second. But I wanted to ask you, because you talked about this in your show on Sunday, John King, that Christie's media offensive, he handpicked two women reporters, Diane Sawyer of ABC and Megyn Kelly of Fox. Was this about just he expected softer questions, although I don't know why he necessarily would, or was it about to kind of the whole sexist charges that were made at him after he went after Bridget Kelly, his aide, the single mother of like 3 or 4 kids? Well, I don't think she's got a job yet. What was that about?
It was more about addressing, and Maggie Haberman, one of our guests, a great reporter from Politico, did a lot of work on this, and I've talked to some Christie folks after. Part of it was the idea of that they knew they were getting accused of sexism, so he wanted to sit down with women. So
okay.
If they asked him those questions, he's sitting across from accomplished women. And look, they work for competing networks, but they're both, both Diane Sawyer and Megyn Kelly are quite capable of asking tough questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Jeb Bush, now with Christie in sort of this limbo situation, we don't know whether he's going to make it through this bridge gate or not. A lot of Republicans seem to be more excited about Jeb Bush, the former president's brother and the previous president's son.
This is my favorite, until it's proven to be not true when neither one of them runs. Some Republicans think it takes a Bush to beat a Clinton. It is kind of funny. And in some ways, it's kind of like, really? As Barbara Bush says, Jeff's mother, I mean, he doesn't have to go far from home for this one. Really? Do we have to have the same two families running all the time? Can't we find anybody else to run for president in this country? However, if you think she's going to run, and you think she's going to win the Democratic nomination without trying all that hard, and then you think, she's a formidable look. I know there are Republicans out there already saying she has her own healthcare baggage. Benghazi, Russia, I get it. She's going to have to defend her record if she runs, but she's a formidable person. I don't think anybody would argue with that. So if you're the Republicans and you're looking at, whoa, we got to beat a Clinton. They're tough. They can raise a lot of money. She's probably, because she's smart, she's probably learned the lessons of her disastrous 2008 run, so she'll be better from losing and learning. They think they need a heavyweight. And so they look at Jeb Bush, who's a policy guy, number one. He's a very rooted, again, you can agree or disagree with him, but I would love to watch Hillary Clinton debate education, debate health care, debate national security, debate tax policy, debate Medicare and Social Security with Jeb Bush. Whether they run or not, I think that would be a great series of debates to take around the country because they're both really smart policy people, and they would surprise you a little bit. The other thing some Republicans, and again, some conservatives say no way, but the guys who think one of the reasons Mitt Romney lost was the whole silliness of self-deport is that Jeb Bush speaks the language, Spanish, and he has views on immigration that are not those of the hard right conservative base. He thinks the Republicans need to get a life and realize that, you're not going to round up and kick out 11 million or roughly people. So why don't we find a path to status or a path to citizenship and a new guest worker program and figure out what the way to make this work? So for their demographic problems, a lot of Republicans also think Jeb Bush is better than, say, somebody, like a Ted Cruz. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to run, but it's fun to watch.
If I had, we had spoken to you, and we may have, the day or two after George the Younger finished his term in office, and I had said to you, what would you say the odds were in 4 or 8 years that a third Bush is going to run for the presidency? What odds would you have laid, John King?
Pretty high, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I think if it's not Jeb, it'll be George P. in 10 or 12 years down the road. He's running, Jeb's son is running in Texas right now. Look, it's a family, we get overly cynical sometimes. In some ways, I think it's a good thing, especially when you have people who could, if they wanted to, and sometimes they do between running for office, make a boatload of money, who actually care about public service. I think whatever you think of the Bush family or whatever a lot of conservatives think of the Kennedy family, they care about public service, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And we've had the same conversation about Governor Romney, a guy who's very wealthy, who doesn't need this. But I think he cares about public service. Does he have an ego? Of course you do. To be at this level of national politics, of course you have to have a big ego. But I also think most of them actually care about public service. He's got experience as a two-term governor. The family cares about it. And guess what? You know, name matters. We make jokes about the celebrity part of it. But do you think George W. Bush, do you think he had a heads up when he ran in 2000?
No, I don't think so.
Bush?
No.
And by the way, George Bush the Elder is getting a Profile in Courage Award from the Kennedy Library for his tax-raising position when he was the President of the United States. Hey, John, you probably know I'm from Philadelphia. I'm not from Dorchester. And for someone who's not from Dorchester, the word I hear is that late at night, people like you, Sheldon Adelson, Marty Walsh, all get on the phone together and talk. Is there any truth to that, first, or not? You can be honest.
You'd be advised on a need-to-know basis. You don't have the proper clearance to get in on the Erie Pub Peabody Tavern conversations. Those are all very top secret.
Okay, then forget that. Sheldon Adelson spent $60, $80 million trying to elect a president.
I think it was 93, actually.
Whatever, yeah. And by the way, it was a great Barwitz story we mentioned yesterday. Andy Barwitz says that after meeting with all the Republican candidates, he decided not to buy any of them when they were in Las Vegas. The Sheldon Adelsons in 2014 and in 2016, they are huge, are they not? I mean, the handful of unbelievably wealthy Democrats and Republicans who can spend unlimited amounts of money are the prizes of the early phases of this, yes?
Well, there's no question, because if you get backing like that behind you, number one, if there's a guy, you know, sitting next to you who has a relatively similar profile, similar record, but can't, you know, can raise $10 or $20 million, and you've got a guy who's willing to spend $60 or $80 million to help you, math does matter. It doesn't mean you can't beat money in politics. Of course you can.
But
it matters a lot. And look, there, you know, a lot of people out there get these emails from whatever organizations, you know, you're involved with, saying, you know, send $5 now, send $10 now. And when you look at a Sheldon Adelson spending $92, $93 million, sometimes you want to laugh, you know. The Citizens United decision has tipped the scales. It was happening anyway. I don't want to just say it's all Citizens United. There was a lot of money getting into politics anyway. But there's much more of it now in direct ways because of this. And it is the world we live in. And a lot of people wish they could put the genie back in the bottle. And someday the country will have a debate about this. But it's not going to happen in the next few cycles. So the deep pocket guys have so much sway.
So when the Republicans, a bunch of Republicans who want to be president, ran to Las Vegas for an audience with both Sheldon Adelson and other organizations who are very concerned about Israel and issues that affect Jewish Americans, that sort of thing. Is anybody come out the winner so far? Is there anybody winning the Adelson sweepstakes?
I think the biggest headline is that no one person won, which shows you how wide open the Republican race is. There's no question that from every source I've spoken to, that Sheldon very much is enamored by Jeb Bush and thinks that he is the right policy profile and has the right stature to be a credible candidate in the next election. And remember, he's out in Vegas, probably has different views on immigration than, say, you know, Pat Buchanan or Lou Dobbs or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. So they look at that. But because Jeb has not given clear word that he's running, Sheldon Adelson and a whole bunch of other people are still looking around for another horse. A lot of them, right after his reelection victory, a lot of them said Christie's going to be a very serious player and we're going to, you know, take a real hard look at him. Now they're not so sure about him. And so they're looking around. The buzz out of that meeting was that Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, did himself well. I'm not saying he locked up anybody, but he did himself well. And even though Marco Rubio didn't go out there, remember, this is a group you mentioned. It's the Republican Jewish Coalition, very pro-Israel, very muscular foreign policy views, most of them. And so they listen to Rand Paul and even Ted Cruz, the guys who are more libertarian or more, let's not be as involved in the world as we used to be. And that makes them nervous. So Marco Rubio actually has tried to reestablish himself of late by speaking out about Russia, speaking out about Venezuela, doing more foreign policy, or more muscular, McCain-esque-like foreign policy. And he has open some eyes among that crowd who think that, you know, if you don't have a Christie or you don't have a Jeb Bush and the competition is Rand Paul, watch for some of them to potentially gravitate toward Rubio.
So, John, before you go, you tweeted this, 161-1, that's what you think the ultimate outcome is for the Red Sox, give or take a win or two? Is that what you're thinking?
I think we're going to need, because the Orioles are a better team, the Blue Jays are a better team, what's that team in New York? The guys that wear pinstripes, I don't know what they call themselves.
Yeah.
Everybody's better this year, so I think it's going to take 101, maybe 103, maybe even 105. Maybe if they all keep beating up on each other in a division, I'm wrong about that. If the Red Sox and the Orioles and the Blue Jays just keep splitting with each other, maybe you win the division with lesser wins. But I would aim for triple digits because it's a tough division, and you can't win them all. That's the frustration.
Listen
and the glory
to the excitement
of baseball.
In this guy's voice.
It's amazing. He can know everything there is to know about politics, and he also knows everything there is to know about the Red Sox. I find that quite impressive.
I'll tell you
John
one thing. We left all those men on base yesterday. I'm going to say this right now. I wish we had Jacoby Ellsbury. We needed, and because Victorino's hurt too. We needed somebody to get around the bases a little faster. I love our big guys, but it's station to station baseball. Remember the 70s people? Yeah.
John,
you got to be able to run. Okay.
It's a pleasure. We'll talk to you
John,
in a week.
Thank you very much for
Thanks,
being
John.
With us. John Take King care. Is CNN's chief national correspondent, a huge Red Sox fan, and the host of the Sunday morning show, Inside Politics. Up next, we check in with MBTA General Manager Beverly Scott for a debrief on last weekend's late-night MBTA debut. That's 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
A year ago, the Marathon bombings prompted an outpouring of grief and a massive response by law enforcement. For some Boston residents, that was a sharp contrast to the violence they experience every day.
It really boils down to the fact that black and brown lives are not held on par with our white counterparts in this country and certainly not in this city.
I'm reporter Adam Riley. The Boston Marathon bombings, violence, and race this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, serving New England since 1980, now offering moving and storage services coast to coast with offices in major cities across the country. More info at gentlegiant.com.
This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And the best thing about the debut of the late-night MBTA service is finding out how General Manager Beverly Scott ordinarily spends her Friday nights. She joins us on the line now. Beverly Scott, does this song mean anything to you?
Yes, it does.
Well, what is it, please?
It is Game of Thrones.
Now, we learned from Edgar B. Herwick III and others that what you ordinarily would have been doing were you not participating, were you not riding the first night of late night tea service, you would have been watching C-SPAN and Game of Thrones. So what did you do when you got home at 5 a.m.? You turned it on or what?
No, I did not turn it on when I got home. I went ahead and went to sleep. Okay, but
that's her story, and she's sticking to it.
And I'm sticking to it, but I am so waiting for this. Is so different. I am waiting for the 6th of April, so I can see whether the dragons went out or not.
Wait. You know, Beverly Scott, you just never know what state executives are doing in their private time.
I know. It's like you say to yourself, like, lady, will you get a life? Okay, no.
Okay. So, Beverly Scott, I saw you on television last night at Emily Rooney's Greater Boston. You were riding the tee, interviewed by our reporter here, Edgar B. Herwick III. It was the first weekend of late night service. Looked like you were absolutely having a terrific time, and so was everybody else.
Oh, it was so much fun. I was just talking to one of our staff members, and I told him, I said it was actually almost like an opening of a line in a mini kind of way. I mean, I had at least probably about five or six folks who just actually came up, and it's like I've been waiting for this. I mean, and these were, I mean, they were kind of in that kind of between late 20s and late 30, early 40 something. Okay.
Yeah.
And so one was like a couple, and they literally came out specifically. They had been waiting for it. So that there was another young man, and he said, "You just have no idea. I've been just waiting for this. I am so excited." So it was just, it really just felt, honestly, it just felt good. And what really it was such natural movement to me. I mean, that was the part of it. You just kind of, I mean, after all these years, you just kind of get a feeling in your bones. And I mean, there were no balls that dropped or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, we've been very appreciative of all of the, you know, attention that's come to the late night service. But honestly, I just think it's going to be organic. I almost felt like one of those old soap operas. You say to yourself, like, it's going to become like a part of our lives. But that's exactly how it felt. It had one of our customers just said, you know, oh, it just has a good vibe, and that's exactly what it felt like. And so, you know, we're going to be just keep in the ridership. Again, remember, it was a chilly night. It was, you know, it was rainy, but the ridership, I've got numbers off of, don't have them for light rail or bus yet, because that takes a little longer to get. But we've got ridership numbers off of, you know, the out off, you know, red and all of that.
Well, what are those numbers, and how do they compare to what your hopes or expectations were for night one or weekend one?
Yeah, I tell you, we had 19,000 rides on the subway services. Okay, which was really very good. Okay. And you know, getting all this information, everybody's pulling together, but folks were telling me that from our service planning, that if you compared this ridership to what we had during the night owl service, that it was about five times as great. Now, I got to see all the different numbers, but they were just, nobody was trying to pump anything in particular. They were just excited. They said, oh, well, this is, some old timer was over there saying, oh, this is like five times better than it was when we had the night owl service, you know. So this is like, so I can tell you that there were 19,000 rides on Friday and Saturday night that we had on the subway services. And I was over at Park, okay, was one of the stations I went to. Park was the heaviest one that we had, and there were a little bit more than 2,000 that went through Park. And then, of course, you have, like, you know, the next ones that kind of lined up were, like, you know, Harvard and Haymarket and Central Square and Kenmore and those in Downtown Crossing. And all of those stations had combined more than, like, about 1,000+. And then the two that were kind of neck and neck, I would tell you, was red and green. Okay, they were almost tit for tat, and over the two nights, those clocked in at around 5,000 apiece. Okay,
it just had a nice movement. Well, we're talking to Beverly Scott, obviously the general manager of the team. Just to put it in context, Night Owl was the experiment in the early 2000s, which didn't work out. Was a bus only kind of thing.
Yeah.
So to compare more apples to apples rather than all subways and the prominent bus lines to what Night Owl was, which again didn't work.
Exactly.
What is not, put 19,000 in context. 19, is that like a typical week, Sunday? Is it, what is 19,000? It sounds like a lot of people, but I don't know what it is compared to anything else.
Well, see, the thing about it is that it's hard to, because we don't have that slice of time that we have run service. Okay, so what I've had people, I would tell you that, and I've asked them to also run for me, which I haven't seen yet, what it would actually be by season, because we also, it's important what you're getting by, because you got seasonality in the service too. But everything, I don't want to give any comparatives at this point, because I just want to make sure I have the whole deck in front of me. But the general sense of our folks is that it's looking, you know, it's looking good. Okay, so We'll come out in about a week with a fuller piece. We're gonna really looking for our finance and admin committee of our board to be able to go through some good numbers for them. But so far we're feeling good.
We're talking to Beverly Scott, general manager of the MBTA. They debuted their new late night weekend service last weekend. It's a year trial, right, Beverly Scott?
This is a year trial.
So what is going to be determined whether the year trial continues? Is it going to be numbers reaching a high enough level of ridership, or is it going to be contributions? What's going to make a difference?
I think a combination of all of those, and I have continued to say, certainly we're very appreciative of the sponsors that we've had that, you know, have evidenced themselves at this point, but let me make no mistake about it, the real backstop for this one has honestly been MassDOT, okay? So we're really going with a year, okay? We're saying, look, ridership is certainly important, but don't let me fool anyone, because at the end of the day, ridership on none of our services actually winds up paying for the full amount of the service by no stretch of the imagination. And so certainly those sponsorships are important. But the other part that I've said, and these we can provide the data, which is what are we doing in terms of ridership? But the other information that I think is extremely invaluable will wind up being the information is that we collectively as a community wind up. What is it that our businesses are saying? Yeah. What is it that in terms of additional what additional dollars are they bringing in? What are they seeing in terms of being able to do those kinds of translations in terms of what is it actually doing to wind up doing the spurring of economy? Okay, we're going to be doing some surveying to be clear about what are trip purposes, because on the one hand, we know and we're very happy about the fact that we have a very vibrant hospitality industry here, restaurants, but a lot of the people we're sure that are also using the service are using the service for jobs, okay? And so being able to dig down on that kind of data so that we can, as I would say, a total community, have a broader sense of what is the actual benefit, what do we have in terms of income that's really coming for people who now have a better way of being able to wind up getting to those jobs, what is the spin, if you will, that we're receiving as information from people who are saying, well, yes, I'm using this service. And you can just ask the question, and what did you do when you used the service? And did you go to the restaurant? Did you wind up and just have a maybe check some boxes in terms of what did you actually, when you went to the movies, when you went to the this, when you went to the that, what did you actually wind up doing? And then maybe have a qualifier question that says, well, would you have done this anyway or whatever? All of that kind of information, some of which we would be able to do, which is on ridership, but the other portion of it is information that we'll just all have to collectively gather. And I think that when we take that kind of picture on what happens as a result of late night, that will give us a much bigger sense, if you will, of what was the cost as well as what was the benefit.
So explain to people, Beth Scott from the MBTA, when you talk about depending also on the Department of Transportation and on sponsors, what are you talking about? You're talking about money from different corporations? Which ones?
Oh, God. Well, the Boston Globe stepped forward. The Red Sox stepped forward. Stuff at Construction. Dunkin' Donuts. There's been the Mass Restaurant Association. There is a group that actually has basically just formed called I think it's First Boston Alliance. Okay, Future Boston.
Future.
Alliance.
That's the Greg Selko thing. Yeah.
Right. And yeah. So there, and we're expecting that we're you know, it's like I said, organic, that we're just going to be seeing more and more who wind up stepping up. So some of it has been in kind. Some of it is actually we're looking right now that at least that's accounting for a couple of million dollars, but I don't want to be, you know, Pollyannish about this. The service, our estimate is really going to wind up running somewhere around $16 to $17 million a year, okay? And so the rest of it, you know, we could not get out there to run the service if we were not assured of the fact that we would, at the end of the day, be able to pay for it. So we still want all of those sponsorships to wind up coming in. But at the end of the day, MassDOT and this administration have been very clear that they were going to make sure that we could do it the right way, and we could really wind up getting out there for the 1 year to see whether or not the ridership and the interest would be there. This is one where I have to tell you the honest guy's truth. You know, everybody has their own particular service that they want in their community. But when you just look pound for pound, when you have asked our riders and we have asked them, what is the one something that comes through the most that they have wanted to see, it absolutely is to wind up having have later night service.
Hey,
and so this is one where we're going to see people who, I think my secretary said, they're going to show it by voting with their feet, okay? And that's to use the service.
Beverly Scott, one last thing on this, and then we have a couple of other quick non-late-night service things we wanted to run by you. One of the other concerns, I think, legitimate concerns, is the Globe in its first sentence said no arrest. But people are concerned about security late night. Obviously, there's a lot of drinking, which is perfectly fine, as long as you don't bother anybody else and as long as you don't drive. Is there extra security? Can people be assured that since there is a different quality or of the state of affairs of the rider, that they're adequate people out there to make sure everybody's safe when they get home or get to work or get wherever they go?
We certainly have pumped up in, just understanding just the dynamic that you talked about. No question, our transit police, and we've done some pumping up over on our end. But I will tell you the honest, in fact, having this conversation with people, just talking with them, is that one of the best, actually the best, the best kind of deterrent, if you will, to on the security side is honestly energy and people and presence. Okay, mm-hmm. So you can put all the lights, you can put all the police officers that you want out there, but what makes people, I know what makes me, and I'm a single woman, okay, what makes me feel safe is when I wind up going into a place and I'm not just looking at security cameras and lights, I'm seeing other people and other people who are walking around and they're moving.
Yep.
And so that in and of itself is I think going to be is really going to be one of the biggest pluses that we have, not only within the system but actually on the street itself. So I'm feeling very positive just about the additional, just the positive energy that will come in terms of actually making us kind of we'll come awake, if you will, during that that period up until 3 o'clock in the morning.
This is a general manager of the T, Beverly Scott. Beverly, let's just rain a little bit on this late night parade, maybe a drizzle on the late night
okay.
parade for a second.
Okay.
Fares are going up, not a huge amount. Fares are subject to an increase on July 1st. Tell us about that briefly if you can. But also my understanding is that a significant chunk of the additional revenue is going to go to paying people to work on the late night service. Is that not correct?
There will be. Like I said, this service is going to wind up costing roughly about somewhere between about $16-17 million. The increase in terms of fares, it's always been part of the Way Forward package, okay, which is to say that I think one of the things that we all experienced was recognizing the fact that having these long periods where there were no increases in fares. And actually, when the T took the very big increase that it did, around an average of 23%, the T had not had any increase in fares for over a 7-year period of time. And I think that the lesson learned out of all of that is one that transit systems have learned around the country, and that is that it is much better and it's much more responsible to wind up having periodic, much smaller increases that wind up taking place just as a matter of policy. Now, it doesn't mean that every year when you take the look at it that you have to do it, but you certainly, it's much better to wind up trying to have people absorb something that's up to a 5% as opposed to winding up having these 23-25% fare increases that are just like a shot of cold water on folks. And so as part of all of the planning in terms of transportation finance and refinancing and investment, we built in across the board on fares as well as user fees and all of that, that we would in fact wind up having a policy of doing periodic increases, okay? And then, of course, the legislature, as part of the transportation finance piece, put in a provision that we would in fact wind up not going above a 5%. So what we've done on this one is that it is a very, very simple increase to the extent possible. We tried to make sure that it averaged out at the 5%. We took some of the those most vulnerable populations where there really had been the dips in ridership beyond what we had expected, and that's really on the senior disability community on the ride program, and we held those constant. And the other thing that we're doing is on the side with the school kids, okay, is that we have a 5-day and a 7-day pass, and what we've done on that is that we've really average it out on the 7-day pass, so that our recommendation to the board is that you would be able to have a 7-day at the same price, quite candidly, as we have the 5-day, leaving it to parents as to whether or not they want to wind up having it be a 5 or 7-day that their child would be eligible to be able to receive through the schools. Okay, so we're trying to balance all of the moving pieces, but at the end of the day, it does take, you can't make bricks without hay, and it does cost to be able to run the system, but we're trying to do that as responsibly as we can.
I didn't even know you needed hay to make bricks, to tell you the truth.
The voice you're hearing is Beverly Scott. She is general manager of the MBTA. Beverly, there was a disturbing report. People may recall there was a Green Line trolley crashed in a tunnel last month between Kenmore and Fenway Station, and 10 people suffered minor injuries. We learned that State Secretary Richard Davey personally fired the driver of that train in 2010 because he didn't report that his trolley had hit a woman. Now the same driver has been involved in a second accident, but he was reinstated by an arbitrator. So it leaves you wondering how the arbitrator could reinstate him after not reporting this hit. But are there other people that may be reinstated by arbitrators after this kind of gross not doing your duty? What are we to make of this?
Well, I can tell you that I would say some of that probably needs to go to the needs to go into a different venue, because we certainly are not the ones that manage the arbitrators. Okay, but unfortunately, this is not the only time when there have been rulings that have wound up occurring, which we take it as far as we can, where we certainly don't agree with them. What I can assure you is that we're going to take the kind of action over on this end that is prompt and that we feel is absolutely appropriate to the situation. And it was quite unfortunate in that case where the individual was brought back after there had been a termination from over on this end. Once again, everything that we can do over on our end, we will do. Okay, as I said, that was just a very, very unfortunate situation.
But Beverly Scott, I think where Marjorie was going, are there any other I think his name is Sidley Gardner. Are there any other Sidley Gardners in the system who have committed what you consider to be, or Rich Davey consider to be, a fireable offense, who were reinstated, who are now driving the trolley or the train that you or I or Marjorie rides on?
I can't say. Since I've been here, I'm not aware of a situation that where we have fired someone for an egregious situation that of a safety nature, where they've been brought back. But I can't tell you that through the years and the history here at the T that has not occurred. In fact, I'd be lying to you. I'm sure that there have been, but I have no names or numbers. It would surprise me if there have not been situations where there have been people that have been brought back, and that the authority would much prefer that termination that had not been the situation, that the termination would have stood.
You know, last thing before we let you go, Beverly Scott, I have to say I was really excited about this late night tea service, and so I stay up late. I go to Government Center and I waited 2 days, and the train never came.
goodness!
Okay, so Government Center, as everybody knows, is now closed for 2 years.
Yeah.
To do some pretty wonderful things, I should say, in terms of making it accessible and beautiful. Why 2 years? We had Deval Patrick on a month or two ago, and he was crowing about the fact. Actually, it was your boss, Rich Davey, I think. Or maybe it wasn't. I don't know. Talking about replacing a bridge on one weekend. Why does it take 2 years to rehab a T station?
Oh, my goodness, because there's so much going on in there. So the first thing is that this is a station that's got parts of it that, oh, my God, are 50 up to 100 years. This is really going to be a total redo. We got the mechanical systems, electrical systems. This is the last of our key stations, and there are 80 of them that will wind up being accessible. That is not an accessible system, a station right now, fully accessible. We have no elevators, and so there will literally wind up being not only elevators but redundant elevators. Right now, you can't really wind up. The platforms don't permit you to really be able to wind up utilizing the low floor green line vehicles, and so that's all going to be done. So the inside guts of that, if you will, are literally almost going to be torn out, okay, and really fully replaced, in addition to what will become just a beautiful modernization and all of that, very iconic from the outside. So we take a while, okay. Now, what I will tell, sometimes I wish I were just a roll-in bridge structure. There's a whole lot going on under there, okay. But the key thing of it, and this is what I think was just the smart move, and that we know that it's an inconvenience for folks, but we wanted to be able to, one, get it ready and finished as soon as we could, wind up being able to provide certainty. We appreciate just how much is going on in that area. And we had the option of either doing it in a very traditional way, which would have wound up being somewhere between 4 to 4.5 years. Everybody would have been absolutely ready to pull their hair out and probably fricassee us, okay? Or we could wind up saving $20 million, wind up doing it in a 2-year period of time, give our customers certainty. Our commitment is that we're going to bring it back up for revenue service within the 2-year period of time, and actually at the same time wind up being able to do it to wind up saving significantly in terms of that. There is no accolade at the end of the day in terms of having people trying to run from pillar to post, not quite sure exactly. Oh, did they shut this down today? Yeah. Can I wind up doing this? Can I do the other? And the workarounds would have been absolutely outrageous. So far. We've been keeping our eye on – we got so much going on, which is a good thing. We've been keeping our eye on that one as well. Yeah. And, you know, it just seems like and we will continue, but it seems like everything is going – you know, it's going very well. We've been checking the ridership in terms of the shuttle system that we have. Mm-hmm. And quite candidly, most people have at this point in time decided not to use the shuttle system, and they're basically staying within the system and, for the most part, using a whole lot of additional utilization at Haymarket and Park, which we expected. And so far, so good.
Now, as we let you go, Beverly Scott, we believe in transparency big time on this show, Marjorie and I. We want to know, when you applied for the job to be the general manager of the T, were your future employers aware that your favorite show was one where the highest rated episode was a wedding scene where virtually everybody died? Did they know that, or did you choose not to disclose that to them?
Do you know what? I'm sure they probably didn't.
I know. Well, it's a problem, don't you think?
I know. Yeah, but I have to admit that my son and I share this one. I absolutely love fantasy, okay? And I love fantasy. So my son and I, through the years, we have enjoyed that particular. That's the genre that we like to read.
Trolley was great in those days, wasn't it? It was unbelievable.
I'm telling you.
It was really something. Hey, Beverly Scott, it's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us, Beverly Scott.
Oh, it's just a pleasure, and thank you. You take care.
You too. Oh. Up next, stand-up comic Harry Kondabolu joins us. He brings his Brooklyn brand of comedy to Boston. Next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
They say that some folks have never seen Ireland for themselves. Well, what are you waiting for? Join me, Brian O'Donovan, this October for an Irish sojourn through the scenic southwest of Ireland, a place so lush and green, you'll understand why they call it the Emerald Isle. We're also bringing legendary singer-songwriter Robbie O'Connell along for the ride. But space is limited. Please visit wgbh.org/learningtours for more information.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesley.edu. And Craft Boston Spring, featuring 90 contemporary craft artists selling work in jewelry, furniture, wearables, and home decor. Craft Boston at the Cyclorama at the Boston Center for the Arts, April 4th to 6th. Craftboston.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is stand-up comic Harry Kondabolu. Last week, he's on David Letterman. Today, he's on Boston Public Radio. Maybe his publicist is playing an April Fool's joke on tonight. He'll be at Improv Boston. Marjorie will give you the details in a few minutes. Harry, it's great to meet you.
So great to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, pleasure.
It is nice to meet you after we saw you on the David Letterman show. And you were very funny Letterman show. But there was a sort of sad note. You had a traumatic experience at the airport. I think it was LaGuardia Airport, coming back to New York City. Yeah. Please tell our readers
I will
about
first say
what
sometimes
happened.
You get lucky and the jokes write themselves. So yeah. I'm with that. This happened a few years ago, but I landed at LaGuardia. I grew up in Queens, and my father will still pick me up at the airport, which is very sweet, but also I don't drive, so it's necessary. And I get my bags. I'm walking towards the car when this white lady ran in front of me and got into the back of our car thinking it was a taxi cab. And it was funny, like the look on her face of just like when I opened it, and I think she made the connection of like, wait, and then him, and he must. It was just, she didn't even apologize. It was just like, I'm just going to leave, pretend this never happened.
Did she give your father a tip or no?
Right? Well, he didn't start driving, so no, right.
You know, I hope you don't take this the wrong way.
I'm dying to know before you move on. What kind of car was your father driving?
We had an Altima, I think.
Little Altima.
Yeah, it's not a cab.
Okay.
It didn't have cab plates.
Okay.
It didn't
wasn't
have
yellow.
It wasn't
anything.
Yellow. No, there was nothing to indicate that this is a good idea.
No, but it had that huge pink mustache on the front,
right.
So they thought it was.
Okay.
Hey,
okay.
Harry. You know, as I started to say, I don't want you to take it the wrong way because again, I know of you. I don't know you. You have a lot of friends in the building. Marjorie and I this morning were preparing a week from today.
Soon.
We are the hosts at the WGBH Staff Spelling Bee. Huh. And when I look at you, again, this is the part I hope you don't take the wrong. I say, you could probably win that baby, right? Is that a safe assumption?
I made the finals of my fifth grade spelling bee and lost.
Is that true?
Yes. Oh. And so that's as far as I got. And I think at this point, with autocorrect, I'm in the clear. It's funny, though. I mean, I used to write for a TV show called Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. And we actually did a piece about the spelling bee, which I call the Indian Super Bowl. So I feel like it's an incredible thing. But you know, another thing I said in the piece is that it gives me great pleasure to finally say, hey, white people, learn the language.
We're talking to Harry Kondabolu, who is going to be tonight at Improv Boston. Again, Marjorie will give you the times of the show and all those kinds of details in a few minutes. A new CD, which your friend Christina Quinn, I should say, give her a little plug here in the car, gave
to
us.
She's a huge fan. She's
huge. And I am now, too. I listen to this thing. I don't find oral humor. If that's when you're not looking at the human being.
Sure.
I ordinarily don't find it very funny. I literally almost drove off the road. It's called Waiting for 2042. Is that what it is? What's the import of that? What's the point you're trying to make?
2042, according to census figures, is the year when white people will be the minority. And the actual joke on the album is the fact that it's a social construct. Race isn't real. We shouldn't be so upset about it. I think it's also a bit of a play on Waiting for Godot, like the idea, like, are we waiting for something that's not actually going to happen, does not exist, and what are we fearing? But that's a lot for an album cover, so I just made it Waiting for 2042 to make it provocative.
Yeah. You know, it's one thing when you record a CD. Marjorie mentioned you were on Letterman the other day. Were you scared out of your... Well, I even think of somebody I see being on David Letterman. It gets me nervous.
It's an achievement.
Were you I mean, how horrible, how scary was that it before
was,
you started
was
talking?
Big because part of it... Well, first of all, I was wearing a suit.
I noticed,
I've
by the
never
way.
Worn
yes.
a suit. You know, I'm like a sweatshirt jeans kind of guy, so it was just like, okay, I'm wearing a suit. Made Dave happy. Made my father happy. That's great. But yeah, it's the biggest audience I've ever had. You know, I got to do Conan, which, you know, I grew up on Conan, so that's a
Brookline
huge deal.
Kid, local
yeah,
kid.
Right. And, but Letterman is like, I never thought it was in the realm of possibility. So
but is this like
an
athlete?
You
know? Athletes often say they're really nervous for the big game.
Yeah.
And then as soon as they hit the ball or they score the first basket or they get tackled, then they forget and they just do it. Is that once you start, is it sort of like I'm in my zone here? And
At a certain point, you have to remember this is a show. I'm doing another show. I've done 5-minute sets before, and I've played harder audiences than Letterman's audience.
How
like what? Like what? What was a harder audience?
Most shows that comics do when you're working at stuff are in like bars, and sometimes there are people who. I remember doing this one gig in New York. It was at a chicken restaurant. And they said it's a good room to work out in because like the audiences, they're not audiences. They're people that went to eat food and they didn't know there was a show. And you have to play to people. And you can't be angry with them for talking because they didn't expect to be at a show. They just wanted to eat their food.
A chicken restaurant and they have comedy acts come in?
Yeah, it was a terrible idea. It was in the city somewhere. Because comics will go anywhere for stage time just to practice. And at a certain point, once you deal with enough of those, enough chicken restaurants or sports bars or no one, the people are there for the game and you're performing in a pool table, like at that point, you're good with Letterman.
Okay.
Everything you've ever done has prepared you for this moment.
Let me just say, this show, Boston Public Radio, is huge in chicken restaurants.
That's right.
I'm telling you, our demographic, it's huge.
Before we get to how this all started for you, I'm just curious, why don't you drive?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. It's embarrassing. People think, you grew up in New York. You don't need to drive public transportation. I grew up in Queens. Everybody I know drives. I really don't have a good excuse. I think I could easily say, well, you know, things always got in the way. But people are busy. Everyone's busy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I honestly, I just let it I let it wait, and it's a big issue.
Okay, you get some routines out of this. I think not being able to drive.
Yeah,
possibly.
I mean, I'm 31, so I should have figured it out by now. it you know, they say tragedy plus time equals comedy.
Yeah,
it goes back to tragedy after a certain point.
Okay,
actually.
Okay. So you talk about, or people have written about you too, that you came. Your parents are immigrants, from India, and that your mother used to bring you to a Burger King as child, as sort of a melting pot kind of situation. What was that about, please?
Yeah, she was all about being part of America, and I was born here, and she wanted us to be, my brother and I, to be American.
Yep.
And so to be American, you go to fast food restaurants and you eat hamburgers, and it was such a strange, and there was a playground, and there was a way to play with kids, but it was such a strange, well-intentioned kind of thing where, like, this is what Americans do, so that's what you're going to do as well. And even though, like, we're Hindu, and my mom didn't really eat beef growing up, that was never an issue to her. It was like, well, you're an American. You'll adjust and you'll be an American Hindu who eats beef.
And you've also said that everything kind of changed for you on 9/11. Why?
That's a transition from Burger King. That's a very different gear.
It is
a childhood story about growing up with your mom. Now let's get to 9/11. That's the worst day of your life.
To bring you through the childhood years and how you got to be a comedian. But you're right. Maybe there's something between Burger King and 9/11 you'd like to tell us about.
Jump,
yeah, a bit of a jump.
But it's certainly. I mean, I was in college at the time. I went to Bowdoin College up in Brunswick,
you did?
Maine.
Yeah, oh, that's a great school.
New England institution. And, I mean, it was kind of shocking to, growing up in Queens, we grew up in, like, when people talk about 2042 and they talk about this society they're afraid of with whites being the minority and all these different languages, and they're basically just describing Queens. They're describing what I grew up in, and it's wonderful. And so it was strange for me to, like, know that Queens is such an amazing, diverse place, and I grew up with everybody, and then to hear about hate crimes and violence happening in our neighborhoods, even though we've already had the tragedy of 9/11, and now we're dealing with this other, like, now we're being targeted, like, we're all suffering here. And after that, I was 19 at the time, and it politicized me. It made me really question what kind of country we were living in, and if Queens isn't even safe. And I started to be really critical about our government. I started being critical about us as people. Like, what do we need to do to unify and grow? And, it changed my material. It changed what I was presenting. I was different after that. My influences, both in terms of writing and comedy, were very different as well.
That's the voice of Harry Condobolo. He's going to be at the Improv Boston. Again, we'll give you the details in a couple of minutes. I read somewhere in the last couple of days one of your inspirations was the great and brilliant Margaret Cho.
Yeah.
And one of the funniest things, I don't know if you've ever seen her, Margie, one of the funniest things is in one of her videos, there's a bit where her proper parents are sitting in the audience, and she starts telling the foulest jokes and integrates them, and you literally, it makes you think, oh my God, what if my parents were doing this?
Right.
How do your parents feel? I mean, you went to school, you went to a great school, you just mentioned a minute ago, and now you're a stand-up comic? I mean, it's one thing when you show up on Letterman.
Sure.
When you say, hey guys, I want to be a stand-up comic, what kind of reaction did you get?
They always knew it was a thing I loved, and I think they were a little confused, like, why does he always talk about comedy? Why does he always do comedy? But, my path to comedy wasn't as shocking as maybe other comics. I went to Bowdoin College, and then I was an immigrant rights organizer in Seattle, so already they had to adjust, like, okay, he's doing something different. He's not going to law school. He's doing this.
A lot of immigrants rights organizers end up as stand-up comics. Right. So,
Well, they already had to be like, I went from one human rights and immigrant rights, it's not the most stable career path to begin with. I went from one unstable career path to another unstable career path, so they've already adjusted their lenses at that point. And then, I got into the London School of Economics for a master's in human rights, so already it's like, okay, he's doing something different. And while I was applying to LSE, I got found by the HBO Comedy Festival, was on Jimmy Kimmel Live, had a manager, so it was like I was doing two things at once, and I was succeeding with that. Really, comedy was a hobby. And it became a career after it being just a passion, something I love to do. So for them, it's like, this kid got his master's degree. He's already been successful without really trying. What's it going to be like if he actually tries? And so they were behind me. They knew that, like, I had done at least the minimal requirements of getting a master's degree and really making sure I had a backup.
So you grew up in Queens. So you're Brooklyn kid,
Brooklyn
now, right?
Brooklyn now,
yeah. I don't know if you watch. A couple of weeks ago, Spike Lee was on, like, every television show talking about gentrification in Brooklyn. And then the end of the interviews, which he didn't like, is people said, oh, by the way, he lives in a multimillion-dollar townhouse now in Manhattan, so even though he's complaining about Brooklyn. You tell a story on this CD about one of your ultimate Brooklyn experiences, which is the funniest thing. Can you share that with us a little bit? About
sure.
the woman walking with the baby in the carriage.
Sure.
Is this real?
This happened.
You saw this. Okay,
yeah. I mean, that's why sometimes I feel like I was destined to be a stand-up, because when these things happen, like with the woman going into her car and all that, it's just like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do, because why are these things happening? I was walking around my neighborhood, and I saw a black woman pushing a stroller with a white baby in it. And that, you know, that doesn't, to me, immediately I thought, this is the nanny and the child she's taking care of. Though that's not necessarily guaranteed. Genetics is complicated. You don't really know. But based on what I saw, it that seemed clear based on the dynamics. And, you know, as I'm watching this, I'm walking by these two people, I hear the black woman say to this white child, "Toby, your name is Toby. Say it, your name is Toby," which is unbelievable considering, like, I just thought of Roots. And I'm like, wow, this is perhaps the best revenge for slavery ever. This is what a way. This, yes. Instill white guilt early. It was one of those moments. I immediately started writing. Whatever writing slump I was in was done. Like, it was, it's another sign that I am supposed to be a stand-up comic.
Well, you know, there are, when you think of comedy, I mean, you think of white guys, you think of black guys,
right.
You don't think of Asian guys, you don't think of Indian guys.
That's why Margaret Cho was huge for me.
Yeah, exactly.
It changed everything. It changed the it was no longer something I wasn't allowed to do. And even though she was a Korean-American woman, she broke the mold. And you know, even just talking about her act, it's so... So many different things got discussed. You know, she talked about her family, but she also talked about being a woman. She talked about, you know, body image stuff. She talked about being a queer woman. Like, there's so many different things that she talked about that made the identity of a Korean-American woman a lot broader than the mainstream media would have allowed for without her.
Yeah.
And so, to me, you know, even though I was an Indian-American teenager and a man, like, it was, I could relate to somebody who was breaking the mold. And I thought, if she can do it, it's possible now. So huge for me. She was huge.
Can we go back to anxiety for a minute?
Sure.
I'm sorry to deal with my own neuroses through you, but we talked about Letterman. Most of us don't have Letterman-like experiences, but most of us do have experiences we have to perform in some fashion.
Sure.
The beauty of radio or television is nobody's there.
Right.
And so you really don't know how they're reacting for the most part.
Right.
Are you past the point where you stand up? You're like naked, not literally, but
right.
figuratively, in front of a bunch of people. You say something. Do you? If the reaction to the first couple of things you say is not what you hoped it would be, how do you keep going without saying, oh my God, these people hate me. These people think I'm not funny. I got to go through 45 more minutes of this before I can escape. How do you deal with that?
I mean, some of it's muscle memory. Like, you know how to bring an audience back. You know what jokes you can potentially go to. Some of it is... You know, it's confidence. Like, even though you're nervous and you know, like, oh, I'm in a hole early. It's not usually this early, you know.
Do you get nervous, though? I mean, are there moments when you...
Of course. I mean, this is it's an unnatural thing. Like, the fact that the love and laughter of my friends and family wasn't enough for me is strange. I have to go in front of strangers and please them on any random night. Like, none of this is natural in my estimation. But I do think that... You do it enough years and you get out of enough situations. And I've gotten myself out of holes enough times where I'm like, I can find a way. And actually, it changes the game. It's a fun game as opposed to everyone's on board and we're going to see how far we can go with some of this material. That's one game. But the other game is people aren't on board. What can you do? How funny are you in this situation? So it's a different challenge. And, you know, good comics are up for it.
Yeah. And I often wonder, too, because you see this a lot in clubs.
Yeah.
The heckler deal.
Yeah.
I mean, do you try to ignore them, or do you try to address them, or is it play it by ear?
It depends on the kind of heckler they are. You know, like if it's someone who it's their birthday and they want attention, and you hope the MC acknowledges them just so it gets out of the way. But sometimes you acknowledge them and you try to make a joke and you move on. But if someone is drunk and not paying attention and there's not much more you can do, because there's no more embarrassments out. They've already embarrassed themselves, so they don't care if you embarrass them. You know, they just want attention and they don't really know what's going on. So at a certain point, you engage as much as you can. You try to not break the flow of what you're doing, because you know, for me especially, like I'm point based. I have a lot of things I want to discuss. It's not quite an agenda, but there are things I really want to talk about, and it always bums me out when I've lost that. But you know, if it gets to a point where it's like, oh, this show is ruined if you don't leave, you have to go at that point. And part of it, I think, is just because it's people get babysitters, they make a night out, they spend money, sometimes there's a drink minimum, and after all that, some random drunk person has to ruin it for everybody?
No, it's true.
After all that work?
It's true, it's true. Let's get back to this Indian Super Bowl for a minute thing, which is your nickname for the spelling bee, whenever it is.
Yeah.
Now, your attitude is that Indian Americans should own the spelling bee. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think people can treat it any way they want to treat it. I mean, for me, it's been a punchline at us for so long that the idea of owning it at least felt good. Do you know what I mean? Because it was a funny kind of, you're good at school. I'm like, I don't think that's bad necessarily. Oh, you're so successful. Oh, no. Okay. So I think it's a funny thing where, you know, it's been used in this funny way as a weapon, and if you know, we could either go after it, which I'm fine with too, or we can own it, which you know I did on Totally Biased, and I love that clip, and I felt proud of that kid. You know, I met that kid after at a India Abroad Award ceremony that's a popular newspaper in our community, and he did not care who I was at all. I was like, I talked about you on my show, and he's like, I've been on Kimmel. he didn't say it, but it was clear from his face, like, I've been on Kimmel. I don't care what you've said about me.
Hey, the last thing for me, waiting for 2042, as I say, I listened to in my car. It's unbelievable. I listened to the unexpurgated version. And then what dropped out, I didn't even know this, is there's like a clean version. So what do you do? I'm saying, how weird is that? You're yourself.
Yeah.
And then what are you worried that Fred Phelps wasn't going to die or something at all? And you had, I mean, what was up with it? How weird is that? Do you remake it or they, I haven't listened to that one
yet. I didn't know there was a clean version.
Oh, yes,
I guess
there is.
That must be the radio edit for it.
Oh, it is.
I mean, for me, that's fine because if it's just bleeping out words, you know, as long as content's not removed, like, to me, the content's more important. And to be honest, I probably should curse less, you know.
Was this hard for you doing it curse-free this last 20 minutes?
I got through Bowdoin College and London School of Economics without cursing through all my classes, so this wasn't that bad.
Piece of cake, yeah.
Now, I just wonder, we're going to talk after you leave about April Fool's Day. I mean, do you feel an obligation as a comic to have a lot of jokes today?
I mean, not really.
No.
I mean, it's,
what do you think of an adult who's an established journalist in town? I've known Marjorie Egan for 16 years. We'll do this in a second. For 16 years.
Yes.
Year after year, she has done this to me. 5 minutes before she did it this morning, I go to our lead producer, Chelsea Merz, and say, Chelsea, I'm not falling for this again this year. And she did it again. And when she does it, the sense of accomplishment.
What was
it's
it?
Sort of like,
oh,
we can't say it, unfortunately.
It's
we can't. It's a little
words.
Foul.
It's wouldn't bad even make
it. It really was. It was really grotesque. I mean, it's a little childish. Do you not think for a grown woman? Tell the truth.
What just happened 5 minutes ago, Jim?
What do you mean?
Chelsea
did it to us, too. Let's move on.
We both fell for it again. Okay,
hey, Harry, it's great to meet you.
It's really nice to meet you.
Very, very funny guy. Harry Kondabolu.
How close was that, by the way?
It was close.
Okay, it was close enough.
I am a pronunciation challenged person in general, and
but we know who he
is. I do the best I can. Brooklyn-based stand-up comic. You can catch him tonight at the Improv Boston, a 7:30 show and a 9:30 show.
Don't miss it.
You got a great CD. You were great on David Letterman. Congratulations to you, and thanks so much for coming in. Up next, we are going to mark April Fool's Day with remembrances of some of the best and worst pranks. A conversation next, 89.7 WGBH.
Climate change is affecting every continent, says the United Nations, and something has to change.
We are at the point where we have so much information, so much evidence, we can no longer plead ignorance.
The resistance to climate change and why it's killing our planet, that's the conversation next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And the Worcester Art Museum, presenting Nights, featuring works from the Higgins Armory Museum Collection and the Worcester Art Museum. This new experience celebrates the rich history and artistry of this acclaimed collection. WorcesterArt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're halfway through. We are halfway through April 1st. Have you been fooled? Mark the day. We're going to take your calls and what you consider to be the best pranks of all time. Do you have a classic prank that never fails? Is this the holiday you anticipate every year? Just like I said to Hari, that Marjorie does, like a four-year-old. She gets so excited.
That's right.
Do you always play the fool?
Every year.
Like I do. What? In all seriousness. And one of the things I'd like to know, in addition to your the finest prank you've ever been witness to or done at 877-301-8970. What causes a grown-up like you, who's a relatively mature person, to get... After she pranks me this morning, after I swore that it would not happen again, 16 straight years we worked together...
I think it's 18, actually, she says, Jim, but who's counting?
One down, four to go, and that meant her three children and her sister. I mean...
That's right.
Why do you get such satisfaction out of this? I don't understand
it. I don't
know.
It's a tradition. My mother used to do this.
Oh, is that what it was? Your mother?
My mother used to do this. I mean, I remember her getting us all out of bed, saying, the basement is flooding, the basement is flooding. We have to get out of the house. We all go racing out the front door. Or in our pajamas, and she sits there and laughs for 10 minutes. I don't know. I think that's why I do it. But I love it because, you know, you pride yourself on being a man of considerable intellect
and political skill. Thank you very much.
I'd love to see you make a total fool of yourself.
Every year.
Going on. You went on this morning for like several minutes.
I did. Thank you. Okay, fine, Marjorie. It's not. I commended you for it. And I literally, this is no joke, seconds before you came into work this morning, I was talking to Chelsea, and I said, she hasn't done it yet. She's not going to do it this year. Trust me, it's not going to happen. In any case, and Chelsea did us too. By the way, to get you in the spirit, here are some of the greats. According to the Museum of Hoaxes, listen to this. In 1996, the Taco Bell Corporation takes out a full-page ad on April 1st, obviously, which appeared in six major newspapers, announcing it had bought the Liberty Bell and was renaming it the Taco Liberty Bell. People went absolutely nuts. This is one of my favorites, too. 1992 broadcast of NPR's Talk of the Nation revealed that Richard Nixon, in a surprise move, was running for president again. His new campaign slogan, this is all true. I didn't do anything wrong, and I won't do it again. Accompanying his announcement were audio clips of Nixon delivering his candidacy speech. Listeners responded viscerally, flooding the show with calls. Only during the second half of the show did the host, listen to who the host was, John Hockenberry, reveal that the announcement was a practical joke. Nixon's voice was done by comedian Rich Little. I mean, it really...
You know what's great?
What's that?
People are outraged. They call... This makes me have new respect for Taco Bell, actually. I think it's absolutely great. They're outraged. They call up complaining. They're beside themselves. They're outraged about Richard Nixon. They're outraged about Taco Bell. This is another one. This is another great one. This is a while ago, in 1957. But the BBC reported that thanks to a mild winter and the virtual elimination of the dreaded spaghetti weevil, Swiss farmers were enjoying a bumper spaghetti crop. And they had all this footage of Swiss peasants pulling strands of spaghetti down from trees, and huge numbers of people absolutely believed it. They called the BBC wanting to know how they could grow their own spaghetti tree.
It's pathetic. In any case, before we take your calls at 877-301-8970, Marjorie is not alone. Apparently, Ted Cruz of U.S. Senate from Texas fame, he pulls off this April Fool's prank this morning on Fox and Friends when he unveils a Winston Churchill tattoo on his forearm. After you hear him, you'll hear the three hosts responding. Here it is.
I'm very proud to say I'm proud to stand with Winston Churchill. I'm proud to stand, and I got to say my wife was fairly astonished.
You have a tattoo of Winston Churchill? I can smell that cigar from here.
Your wife just wanted her name on your arm. That's all.
Wait a second. Is that henna or is that real?
Oh, almost as big a couple of suckers as I am. 877-301-8970. I know you're into hearing the great pranks. I still do not understand. I understand the mother thing. I understand the genetic composition of this. But I really do not get the joy level that you experience every single... I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's just fun. It's fun to get somebody going. You have to tell them something that's going to get them going, like you were going and saying, oh, you have to report this, you have to do something, you have to call in.
Why don't you tell people what you said the prank was, Marjorie? Go ahead. You can't. Do not even think about it.
It was something that I said... another radio show
had said about you.
They were talking about me this morning, and I claimed
which was true, and you played off that.
And they said that I told Jim that they had said something very, very off color about me, thinking they were off the air.
And I was advising Marjorie as to how she should get it in the newspaper. I took charge.
Jim took charge. So that's the fun part. And when I do these pranks later in the day to my three children and my sister, who I hope is not listening right now, that's it. You get them going, and they're all worked up.
Oh,
this is terrible. What are they going to do? The basement is flooding. Get out of the house, and you get all online, you get everybody worked up, and then you say, April Fool.
You really know how to have a good time, Marjorie. Jim and Grafton, you are first on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey there, Jim.
Hey, how you doing? It's a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate that.
Well, my my prank was, my wife has gotten me a couple of times, but this one's got to be the best one ever. About maybe 7 years ago, when my daughter was like 15 years old, no, she had to be drivable. She asked to stay over a friend's house the night before, and said that you know, there's friends staying over, and you know, the son's supervised and kids, and we go, no, you can't go. So the next morning, my wife woke me up in a sleep stupor. She goes, she stole the car and went over to the house. And I go, what? So I ran up to her room, and she wasn't there. And I looked down the driveway. The car was gone, and I got so mad. And I jumped in the car. She says, we're going over. Get the car. And she's walking home. It's about a five-mile walk. So I'm driving down the road, and my wife moved the car about 100 yards up the road. And I get up by our car and go, hey, isn't our car? My wife turns to me, April Fool.
That is really...
That's great.
So good to hear.
That's great.
Someone is in my class.
She
Jim,
had
thank you.
She going for 10 minutes at least.
Thank you for the call. And you know, that's elaborate. Yours are not quite as elaborate, even though they are brilliantly
Usually,
thought out, I
should
say.
Usually I tell
you
have a spot on your shirt like four times in a single day.
I know,
that
I, go for, I know, that's
you go,
really
oh,
great.
Where's the spot?
Can I tell you right
There's
now?
Something on your head.
You're next year, it's not working. I want to make that totally clear. 877-301-8897. Here's a clip from one of NPR's April Fool's jokes on All Things Considered. Last year, the host, Robert Siegel, does some deep dive reporting on an oral history project to collect the stories of dolphins, Marjorie, that were used by the Navy to find underwater mines during World War II. Listen.
A team of archivists is working around the clock. They are recording and preserving the stories of the work these brave animals did on behalf of this nation. When the project ends, the costly underwater microphones will be sold for scrap. But for now, there's one remaining issue that must be addressed. Curator Corey Storr.
We have no idea what these dolphins are saying. They could be shooting the or singing or talking smack about seals. We have no idea.
877-301-8897. Marjorie's the happiest I've seen her in months.
I really am.
It's just unbelievable.
Here's a great one. This is called The Planetary Alignment Decreases Gravity Hoax.
And what's this?
Where this is the BBC again. I guess they must be big on this in the BBC. They announced, this big astronomer, there's going to be this once-in-a-lifetime astronomical event where Pluto would pass behind Jupiter, and this would cause the gravitational alignment of the Earth would change. And if people, at 9:47 it was going to happen, so it 9:47 in the morning, you were supposed to be able to levitate. Well, hundreds of phone calls from listeners later saying that they were levitating. One woman even reported that she and her 11 friends had risen from their chairs and floated around the room.
That's great. Your mother was probably one of the people who called. John, you're in Newton. You are next on Boston Public Radio. How are you, John?
Hey, Jim and Marjorie, I got to be honest, it took a while to win me over, but now I can't stop listening to your show.
Well, you're sweet to say that, John. Thank you.
You guys might remember, it was in the 80s sometime, it was a local Boston station, and on April Fool's Day, they broadcast a story that Great Blue Hill in Canton had erupted, and they included file footage from Hawaii and molten lava running down, and the switchboard lit up, and whoever came up with this idea was summarily fired, and I thought that was a real lack of a sense of humor.
I am totally with you. I didn't live here yet, but I've heard about it. That is actually a classic Boston one. John, thank you for the kind words, and thank you for the call. Let's go to Worcester, where Drew is on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Drew.
Hi.
Hi.
I am not I don't do April Fool's jokes at all. And
good.
Marjorie, I have a great admiration for you being able to do that. I think that a lot of intelligence to be able to come up with these things. But I did do one.
Tell us.
That I'm quite proud of. I was a Boy Scout leader for a while, and we had a scout meeting that happened to be on April Fool's Day. So I went and I bought one of those magnetic earrings, and I was wearing it around the meeting. I don't think I got any of the scouts. But one of the parents went to one of the other scout leaders and said, aren't we getting kind of progressive here, wearing earrings? And the scout leader turned to him and said, what day is today? And then he got it.
That's a good one.
Listen to the pride in Drew's voice. It's like you. Hey, Drew, thank you. Thank you for the call there.
Julie says that the Anderman brothers, they're the guys that own the Phantom Gourmet.
Good buddies, yes.
They have a good one today on their Facebook page claiming they bought the Hilltop Steakhouse and they're holding a press conference for the media at 4 p.m. in Sioux City.
877-301-8970. We should, next April Fool's, April 1st, mm-hmm. we should have a shrink on with us.
I think we should.
Actually, we offended a bunch of listeners recently when I called, when I said shrink on the air. We should invite a psychologist or psychiatrist on the air with us to explain, again, I'm why people like you, and listen to this guy who just called a minute ago, said he was not into it, he had only done it once in his life, how happy did he sound from the one successful prank that he had done.
Okay, this is the story of the left-handed Whopper.
This is Chelsea's favorite.
This is great.
This is a good one.
Burger King ran a full-page ad
when
in
was
USA
this?
Today.
Whatever, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm looking for the date.
Whatever it was, go ahead.
Anyway, announcing the introduction of a new item to their menu, the left-handed Whopper, specifically designed for people who are left-handed. And the new Whopper included the same ingredients as the original, but they were rearranged 180 degrees, all the condiments, for the benefit of left-handed customers. And the following day, Burger King is deluged. All these people were coming in ordering the left-handed Whopper, and they were distraught to learn that it was but a hoax, Jim.
You know, maybe to make you as happy.
How great is that?
You know what we should do? Next year we should do a two-hour special. You know, why devote just a few minutes to something this important?
I think so.
Really, let's just do a special. Lori,
got to.
You're in JP, Jamaica Plain. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Lori.
Hey, you guys.
Hi.
I love your show.
Thanks.
So I also love April Fool's because my partner is completely gullible. So my very first April Fool's joke was, we don't own a cat, but I wrote this letter and I cut and pasted the Friskies logo onto it, and I said, you have won the grand sweepstakes of an entire year's worth of cat food. So the requirement is that you have to have room to store the 1,200 cans of cat food that will be arriving on April 1st.
That's pretty good. How long did your partner go for this one?
She got really upset. She was ready to call Christie's number until I said no.
That's pretty good, actually. That is quite good. Lori, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Haven't you done April Fool's jokes on your kids? I mean,
no,
you're a
no.
funny
when
guy.
When they were four, Marjorie, I did it. I didn't do it like you do it on adults. Your children are young adults. Your sister is an adult.
Never too old for a good Whopper on April Fool's Day is my attitude.
Are your kids as gullible and your sister as gullible? I mean, by the way, I hope people don't think I'm kidding. We have worked together. Marjorie thinks it's 18 years. I think it's 16. Whatever it is.
1996, Jim.
Well, no, it's not true. Actually,
however long
it has been, I'm not exaggerating. Every single year, about halfway through, I started anticipating it and deciding I'm not going to fall for it again. And every single year, I'm on the schneid.
The best ones. And when you fall for it, within like 2 minutes, Jim, you have a rip in your pants.
Yeah, I know. Okay,
and then 2 seconds later, Jim, you have a rip in your shirt.
I know. I still fall for that, too.
It's unbelievable.
I know. Well, I feel bad for you. I know how much it means to you.
Okay.
I don't want to disappoint you. Let's take just like one more here because I can't take anymore.
Okay. Brad from Plymouth. Thanks for calling, Brad.
Hey, Brad.
Hi, great to talk to you. I've got two quick ones. First, I got an email this morning from Trulia, which is the online real estate site.
Mm-hmm.
They deliver listings to people and stuff. They said that from now on, they're going to be an online dating site.
That's pretty good, actually.
That's a good one. Did you fall for it?
No, that actually reminded me that I had to come up with something for my girlfriend. So I just told her there was a green horse on the lawn. And, it's pretty weak, but she went and looked.
Well, I would have looked. I mean, it's not weak. If Marjorie had come in to me and say, Jim, you will not believe this. This is good for our show. There's a green horse on North Beacon Street. I'd go look at the green horse and figure I have a scoop. Brad, thank you for the call. I said we were done. I came so excited. One more and then we're really done.
Okay, one more. Lori Ann
in Lunenburg. Hey, Lori Ann.
Hi, it's Lori Ann from Lunenburg.
Hi.
I love you guys so much. I have you in my contacts now so I can call and comment on stuff.
Oh, thank you, Lori Ann.
That's a good one. Hey, what's up?
Over this past summer, during the pledge drive,
yeah.
I had gotten in the car and I turned the radio on and it was in the middle of the story, so it was out of context. It was the NPR story about cheese mining and about how the cheese was being depleted and the lines of cheese were, you know, all almost dried up and stuff. And it had me going. I'm like, wait, cheese doesn't come from the ground. It's not mine. Cheese comes from cows, doesn't it? I mean, and I actually went in my sister's house and I asked her about it. I'm like, cheese comes from cows, right? Because it had me going because I didn't realize it was out of, you know, it was during the summer. And that's my favorite NPR story.
Can I tell you something, Lorianne? You should leave your phone number so Marjorie can call you next April 1st because I think you're even a better target than I am.
So, Lorianne, this means, I suppose, that you would not have bought the idea about the spaghetti growing in trees and the fine harvest.
Oh, I think she would have, actually.
I would have.
Yes.
But this morning I was on to it. So when I heard the story, I know what the story is for today. I'm like, that's not true. I know it.
You got it now, Lorianne. Hey, Lorianne, thanks so much for putting us on speed dial and thanks for the
very
call.
Much for the call. Okay, Jim, you have a hole in your pants.
No, I'm not. But I'm telling you, I have 365 days to prepare for next
That's
year.
Right, you
it's
do.
Not happening. Okay. It's ending at 16 or 18 or whatever it is. No more. No, I'm serious about this. No more.
Up next, we are going to talk about something that is no laughing matter, actually. Income inequality. Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
A year ago, the Marathon bombings prompted an outpouring of grief and a massive response by law enforcement. For some Boston residents, that was a sharp contrast to the violence they experience every day.
It really boils down to the fact that black and brown lives are not held on par with our white counterparts in this country and certainly not in this city.
I'm reporter Adam Riley. The Boston Marathon bombings, violence, and race, this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Mass Eye and Ear. Sense life, experience life. When vision problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And the story of the Jews with Simon Shama. Explore the Jewish experience from ancient times to the present day in this five-part series. The story of the Jews continues tonight at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, as you probably know, even though one is in the works now, is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, great to be here.
Thank you for coming in, Nancy. So income inequality is a big buzzword. You know, Pope Francis is talking about it, and Barack Obama is talking about it, and lots of us, we've talked about it many times. But now there's this new book by this new economist that's getting a load of buzz about the same subject. So fill us in, please.
So Thomas Piketty is a French economist. I make him to be in his early 40s if I've done the backward math on it. He, very well trained, spent some time at MIT and, you know, has talked about that a little bit, what he learned by being in the new world, so to speak, or being in America, found his experience here to be a little, in academics, to be a little too devoid, I think, or a little too distant from real world problems, and has spent what sounds like, I mean, I haven't read a lot about this, but what sounds like, you know, a decade assembling with Emmanuel Saez, who many of our listeners will know as a well-published and very knowledgeable, very credible economist of income and wealth inequality, who has an appointment at Berkeley, has spent a lot of time with Saez developing what sounds like a really, really important set of data around not just inequality in the United States, not just inequality in Europe, but inequality all over the world. And the data is data that's not just for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, but goes way back. So he has come with the data assembled with Saez to a series of, I think, very powerful, thought-provoking, and what will stand as flagstone-like arguments or contentions about inequality's natural tendencies in capitalism. The name of the book, Thomas Piketty, PICKETTY, Harvard University Press. They moved the press date up, something academic presses rarely do because it's gotten so much traction with reviewers and economists and commentators on business and capitalism. They moved the release date up till March. It's just come out, 696 pages, count them. He has come to a series of very interesting conclusions. The title of the book is Capital in the 21st Century, and John Cassidy, who's reviewed it in a very interesting piece in The New Yorker, the most recent edition, you know, and others have commented on the kind of parallels between calling a book Capital and Marx's Das Kapital. And they both are, I believe, going to be, or Marx's book is, but Piketty's work is going to be a kind of, you know, touchstone for how we think about the operations of global capitalism.
Why?
For many, many years to come. Because like Wealth of Nations, I put it in that camp very carefully, or David Ricardo, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, or Ricardo's political Principles of Political Economy, published about 44 years after Smith's book in 1776. Like both those books, he's laying down a set of arguments about how capitalism works as a kind of organic, you know, machine, organic set of relationships. And he's doing something very interestingly distinct from Ricardo or Smith, but more akin to Marx, saying you can't really divorce capitalism and what we get from the political, from political actions, from the relationship between politics and economy. You need to think about the workings of capitalism in the context of the old-fashioned word political economy. Very, very interesting. Very, you know, a lot of us would recognize that, the truth of that. But here's the real point. So the point of the book is capitalism has a bunch of different principles that we need to think about the way it works and consider this as its natural default drive. One of which is, and this moves strongly in contrast to the way many of us, politicians, policymakers, economists today have for at least 50 or 60 years thought about, maybe 70, thought about capitalism, and that is that left to its own devices, you know, incomes will tend over a certain stage of development to come together, to converge. He's saying exactly the opposite, that there are driving forces, not just today, but over the long run, that actually move incomes in opposite directions, that diverge, that create a rigid class of people. Think about, you know, the French Revolution, or think about old world society, a rigid class system in which a small group of people control the majority of the wealth and the income, and that contrary to the way most
poor America in 2014.
Bingo. Right. Okay. And he has his numbers that make your jaws drop. But we can recognize the truth of this. Let me just sprinkle this, you know, long winded explanation with a few of them, little breadcrumbs. In 2012, the top 1% of the income distribution collected 22.5% of the income. If you widen that to the top 10%, it's more than 45% of the income. Or to get even more shocking but true, all 95% of the income growth since the beginning of the Great Recession through 2012, 95% has gone to the top 1%. So all that money, all that gold off the table went to the top 1%. So he's arguing that actually the 50 years or 40 years of income equality, of convergence between, say, roughly 1945 and 1975 was an aberration. An aberration. So
Because of depressions, wars, and
rebuilding,
those sort of things, yeah.
Right?
And also, we had much, much higher tax rates.
Here we go. He's arguing, you leave this animal, this organism, this ecosystem alone, and you're going to create Marie Antoinette and everybody else all over again, right? In modern day America, Europe, developing countries, China. His data show remarkable trends toward this effect after a certain stage of development in lots and lots of places. So absent government policy, absent progressive, intentional action, this is what we may end up with. And he says, isn't it ironic? In the land of America, right, we're going to end up with Balzac's Pere Goriot, Jane Austen's tiny little group of, you know, wealthy aristocrats in Mansfield Park, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, one of the things I've always found fascinating reading about the, you know, period of enormous growth in the United States, what is our tax rate now, like 33 or something like that?
Mid-30s, mid-30s. Yeah, top rate.
And at the time of JFK, the rates on the most wealthy were up like close to 90%. Yep. I mean, it was like crazy. And they were very high during World War II as well. But yep. I can't. So was that a big deal?
He thinks that's a big deal. And in fact,
allowing the middle class to grow.
Well, yeah. And in redistributing income, which he says, left to its own devices, will default into divergence, right? So yes. And then one of the most controversial parts of the book is his call for a kind of global tax, right? A kind of global wealth tax. And he's got different kind of, you can double click on that in a sense in the book and learn and see alternatives to that. That is what, if you look at the firestorm of conversation around this, that not interesting enough, not his conclusions, not the raison d'etre of this book, not the highway along which the arguments and the data and the significance of what he's writing about travel. That's not getting tons and tons of controversy. What's getting controversy is his political, you know, his suggested political or policy solutions to this. I think
it's a non-solution, though. I mean,
it's a non-starter, right?
Exactly. I mean,
we can't agree on carbon emissions.
Exactly.
Right?
And his view as to why it's got to be a global progressive wealth tax is because, as most people who aren't economists know, that one of the ways the wealthy avoid progressive taxation mm-hmm. is they transfer their assets yep. to places that, if you want to go state to state, Florida, yep. you go to New Hampshire, has no income tax. You go to Florida, which has no estate tax.
Right.
Or you go to another country. The whole notion is a global wealth tax would capture all this. But even he acknowledges it's beyond unlikely. And so what I say as a non-economist is, and when I was reading all this stuff about him, while it seems that he has great insight, and I obviously virtually everybody in your line of work thinks he has colossal insight,
said something very, very important based on good data.
But if you don't have a solution that's plausible to this collection of good data, what have you added to the, not you, what has he added to the conversation?
So, so it's interesting that you say that, Jim, because I actually come at it from exactly the opposite standpoint. I think, boy, this guy has done his homework, and what an important moment for, you know, the kind of rarefied era of economic academics to jump into, you know, into our world conversation. So here's what he's done. Here's the contribution. If you were at Harvard Business School, this is why you would give him a 1 for his class participation, because he has really, really strong evidence that this is happening and it will worsen. Now, you can quibble and argue and stack, kind of poke that pig, if you will. But let me tell you, I don't think you're going to break the skin in a huge way. That in itself, it's a little bit like where we've arrived with climate change. It's getting harder and harder, right? Just look at the weather patterns to say climate change and global warming are some kind of, you know, fantasy made up by liberal tree huggers. So I think what he's done is contribute an enormous amount of credibility to the idea that we have a worsening, serious global issue. Very few people have assembled the kind of data and written with the kind of boldness, supported boldness, that Thomas Piketty has.
Decent set of facts that people of different political views yep. can agree upon, in theory,
we get closer to
actually,
a policy conversation and solution.
Because the economists that would be drawn into this administration or around the world,
or Republican administrations, right?
Great
or the
Britain
World
or
Bank
France.
Or the IMF.
Okay.
Exactly.
What might be coming from
exactly.
the same.
Exactly. So
what I don't understand about this, so I apparently wrongly assumed that this income inequality thing was much worse. We always talk about how, you know, there was this great piece in the New York Times over the weekend talking about how back in the Gilded Age, John Pierpont Morgan was endorsing a 20-to-1 ratio between what the CEO made right. and what the worker made. And now we're up to 354 times the CEOs make 354 times what the worker made. So I wrongly thought this was fairly new. But what you're saying is it's not. It's just other government interventions kept it to be less dramatic.
Well, a combination of forces, right? I think equalized wealth. And he's arguing this. I can't take any credit, right?
Okay.
A combination of forces, right? Everything from the demolition of Europe and the rebuilding there to, you know, a lot of wealth destroyed, right? A lot of wealthy people's wealth destroyed. Just think about art collections during the Second World War. A lot of different forces. Government action was one of those, and particularly in America. But I think that we don't have any real numbers on CEO to average worker pay. You know, we don't have them very far back at all. They only go back really reliably to the 1950s. But those numbers astoundingly diverge in that time, right? So 20-to-1 is the average large company's CEO pay to the average worker in the mid-1950s.
Yeah.
Right? By the 1980s, it's 200-to-1. By today, right, it's over 300-to-1.
Right.
There's one astounding statistic in the John Cassie Review In 2011, Tim Cook took home $378 million in cash and stock-based compensation as the CEO of Apple. That was 6,258 times what the typical Apple worker made. So one of the very – stay with me on this. This is really important. It's Piketty's. It belongs completely to him, but it's really important. It's another way he's going to change the conversation. Mm-hmm. He argues that the huge amount of the wealth in America that has gone to the top 1% is not being generated by – you know, Oprah Winfrey making $77 million last year, which she did. Highest paid celebrity in America. I learned that because I just taught Oprah Winfrey in my leadership class. It's not being generated by that. It's actually being generated by CEO compensation. And then he made a huge percentage of it. 70% of that diversion of income going to the top 1%, he argues, is the C-suite. And that means it's boards of directors, it's compensation consultants, right? It's shareholders who don't have legal means to really challenge that and stop that railroad, that rail engine on the tracks. But then he says, isn't it ironic that we're doing that and we're somehow attributing superstar status to managers and corporate officers who by definition do things in a group? So it's very hard to attribute huge amounts of performance, even if performance-based compensation actually had legal and practical teeth, which we know it doesn't. There are lots of CEOs from lousily performing companies who are taking home a big pot of gold at the end of the week. He said, isn't it interesting that ironically we're giving these individuals who work in a group and who by definition do things in a group, we're singling them out and actually feeding the monster of massively diverging income inequality.
Let me throw a few things in.
So
this
that's
mix,
a
by the way.
Really important piece
yeah.
by the
of
way,
this compensation, the compensation, you know, if you will, conversation we need to be looking at.
Now, even if Nancy Kane is right, and she knows a little bit more about this than I do, I would acknowledge.
She
even
does,
if she's
Jimmy,
right, yeah, it's
sure?
shocking. Even if it turns out she's right that operating, at least for most people, from the same set of data is a good start. We are so far away from dealing with any. By the way, Piketty, while he wants his global wealth tax that he admits is unlikely, thinks the solutions, and I use that term in quote, that are being advanced by governments like ours are going to accomplish virtually nothing. And let's talk about the current state of affairs. We have a proposal by the president that is going nowhere to raise the minimum wage to $10.10. And while people are fighting for that, the National Low Income Housing Coalition says to rent a modest apartment in this country and just break even and have all those expenses, you need $18.92 an hour to break even and have no money left over. Democrats and a few Republicans are fighting for almost roughly half that, and they're not going to achieve it. Number two, what I had forgotten about or never knew until Marjorie mentioned this piece that about the income gap that you two were talking about between the CEOs and their line workers is when you said before, we really don't know the most current data, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, about the ratio. One of the reasons
from the past. We don't know it from very far back.
We don't even know it from the current, because this is what I didn't know. In the Dodd-Frank bill, there was a provision that would have forced American companies to disclose the ratio of the compensation of their CEO to the median compensation of their employees, which would give us the same kind of data that you're praising with Piketty, because at least we know the facts. Exactly.
SEC documents.
And what is Congress's response to the bill that they passed into law? To delay for 4 years the disclosure. Now, what does that mean? It means we're never going to see the information. When it comes close to 4 years, they'll delay it another 5 years. So even if we agree, Nancy Kane, that the data from Piketty is being celebrated from coast to coast and beyond, what's the breakthrough moment? Who is the breakthrough person? What's the breakthrough idea that's going to rally left, right, and middle to begin to solve this problem? Because a lot of people, do they buy the notion that it even is a problem?
I don't think they do. We would have this conversation many times on our previous radio station about a guy like Tim Cook with
Well, he's making a billion after that, right?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know what he's making now.
I don't know what he made last year, but I gave you the figure.
$378 million. And something in me says that's really kind of gross, that this isn't something that we should laud or think is wonderful. I mean, what do you do after the first $50 million? You know, I think he can squeak by. But you get calls from people who say, This is a capitalist country. You free can make as much as you want. This is free enterprise. Blah 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 blah. It's so bizarre.
I've been at the Harvard Business School 21 years. It's a an astounding place. And it's not that we don't have our issues, but it's an astounding crucible to kind of grow up as a historian. And again, I've said this before on the air. I think historians generally get better as we age, like wine, right? And spaghetti, second
spaghetti.
Day, right? Spaghetti sauce much better the second day.
The sauce,
the fourth day, right? So, one of the things I think about when I think about a question like that, or your question, Jim, so I want to take Marjorie's first and come back to yours, is, look, we want to reward people to incentivize and to recognize, to incentivize them to do their best work, and that includes paying people that have responsibility for large organizations, a healthy salary or healthy compensation, and we want to recognize what they've done. So, no one is talking, at least in my worlds and the worlds that I read about some kind of cooperative arrangement for compensating, executives, but it's about the magnitude. It's about the levels. We're not talking, should we pay, a CEO $10 million or should we pay them $3 million? We're talking about $378 million or $500 million or $80 million in the case of some CEOs where the company's stock price and market performance was much below expectation and shareholders and employees suffered. So we're talking about orders of magnitude. We're also talking about signaling. Right? What is the signal this sends to Americans and the rest of the world about what our economy and our corporate sector is really about? And then we're talking about something even more important than both of those, which is think about the categorical imperative of Kant, right? Act only on things that you are prepared to see generalized, right? That was his idea about a kind of, bedrock for morality. It's really interesting when you start thinking about it. Do we really want, I don't care how much wealth we have or don't have or aspire to have, do we, any of us, as Americans or as members of a global village, really want to live in a let them eat cake society in which a very, very small number of people take a lot of the gold, most of the gold, 95% of the income growth of the gold. And I don't care whether you are the wealthiest person in this country. If you really are prepared to act on what that looks like in 20 years, your answer is no. It is no, because that is a society of increased suffering, of increased social instability.
Well, that's one of the reasons the Occupy movement, as short-lived as it was had really such resonance with so many
beginning.
People.
So here's the answer.
It's just the beginning.
That's the lead into the answer to your question, Jim. So what's the breakthrough moment? I mean, why don't you ask, Fred Shuttlesworth, who led the on-the-street organizations in Birmingham in 1963 against Bull Connor, they didn't know that was going to be the breakthrough moment. It was a breakthrough moment, right? Or some of those students in Greensboro who sat down. They've been sitting down for a lot of years. Or ask Lincoln, was the Emancipation Proclamation going to change everything? He didn't know that. It was, but he didn't know that. Robert Moses, who was a civil rights worker who went on to lead the Algebra Project out of Cambridge and has really changed the face of a lot of high school education, particularly for black minority students in America. The breakthrough moment is never something we can pinpoint. But until we really start lighting the kindling, we're never going to set it afire and get a breakthrough blaze. So we're beginning to do that here, and we need to do that because the answer to the question, do you really want to live in let them eat cake society, for almost everybody is no.
Nancy, you spend a lot of time in leadership courses and interviews you do with some pretty high-profile executives in this country. If you were talking to them and there was no tape recorder and you said this was off the record and you were to say to them, do you think the fact that Tim Cook makes, 6,000 times what the median worker at Apple makes, or the average American CEO makes 354 times at least what the average median worker in his or her corporation makes, would they say yes to you?
I think most smart thinking, broad-looking executives would say, yes, this has gotten out of hand. Right.
They wouldn't say this is what we need to compete in the global marketplace.
I don't think so.
In
a very candid, no, because why? Because what got these people in most cases, not all cases, but what got them to the place they have is the ability to see not just right now, but beyond, and what it means not just for them, right, but for their customers, or their continued market ability to market to lots of customers, or their continued ability to hire well-trained workers. All those things, are vulnerable when we get closer and closer to let them eat cake.
Yeah, who should lead the movement, Nancy? Yeah, we're
she
looking
should lead
at
the
her.
Movement.
Exactly.
That's
I'd
right.
Follow.
I think Nancy
I'm
Kane
serious,
is our breakthrough
Nancy.
Moment right over there. Okay. Nancy, you are fantastic. That was wonderful. Nancy's an historian at Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. I always love to talk to you, Nancy. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We've got the Boston Globe editor, Brian McGroy, with us, and medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.